Hey folks, Damian Mason coming at you. Before we hop into another fantastic episode of the Business of Agriculture, I want to tell you about Pattern Ag. Pattern Ag is a company that has pioneered predictive soil analytics. You know, we always treated diseases and pests after they were already in the field, when they were already causing us a problem. But what if you can do this proactively through predictive soil analytics? Pattern has a technology that through their technology, you can say, oh, here's the likelihood that I'm going to have soybean cyst nematode. Here is the prediction on how bad of a risk I face for sudden death syndrome or corn rootworm and a whole bunch of other diseases and pests. When you know what your risk factor is, you can more efficiently and proactively treat for the disease. You can do this by going to pattern.ag and figuring out what your risk factors are through predictive analytics. That's right. Go to www.pattern.ag and then get a hold of your Pattern Ag representative to help you do predictive analytics on your farming operation. Well, greetings and welcome to another fantastic episode of the Business of Agriculture. Got a great subject for you today that you probably are not going to hear this kind of perspective on other formats. We're talking about Florida agriculture in the aftermath of Hurricane Ian. Got a great guest. His name is Nathan Carson. He's the Vice President of Operations for Chemical Dynamics, a fertilizer blender in Plant City, Florida. We're going to talk about specialty crops, the impact on specialty crops, produce, especially trees, tree fruits, and what that big, huge, nasty hurricane is doing to the production, but also then about the supply chain, which we've had all kinds of talks about that in the last 2.5 years. And then what this means for us in the business of agriculture. You know, a lot of fertilizer comes out of Florida, and we're going to talk about the fertilizer markets, which we just were getting back to being recovered on. And we had gone through all this tumult. We had gone through doubling of prices. And now all of a sudden there's this new disruption. Also then about weather's impact, not just in Florida, but on fertilizer, where we're talking about the Mississippi River is going dry and barge traffic has been slowed to a halt. All that's going to be covered in this episode. All right, Nathan Carson, VP Operations, Chemical Dynamics. What the hell is Chemical Dynamics?
Chemical Dynamics is a family-owned fertilizer blender located in Plant City, Florida. So my grandfather started the company about 50 years ago, come in January. So, you know, really looking forward to going strong, 3 generations in the business. So I kind of oversee the supply chain and the operational elements of the business. And so that involves dealing with rail cars and the railroads and the railroad strikes that are going on. That's been a constant headache for me the past few months, dealing with trucks coming in, dealing with just getting delivery drivers in general. So all the supply chain elements that and labor elements that had headaches that we've had over the past couple of years, I've been ground zero on. Our bread and butter is dealing with specialty fertilizers, especially in the micronutrients. In the Plant City area, working with strawberry growers, working with Florida citrus. We're also doing a little bit of business these days out in the Mississippi Delta. And so all of these different weather elements, whether this is drought in the South, Mississippi River Basin, everything that you're talking about. I mean, we're ground zero for all these trends.
That's why you're on here. A gal named Mary Hartney that's with a trade group in Florida is who recommended you, because really, I don't want to, in this discussion we're having, it's like it can go a lot of directions, you know, and that's why when we did our pre-call, the listeners right now are like, what do you mean? We're going to cover everything. And that's why, I mean, you've got a good read on just about everything. To say it's Hurricane Ian discussion is like, yeah, that's part of it. My buddy Todd Thurman, who hosts the Business of Agriculture Success Group with me, co-hosts it with me, said something pretty smart a couple of years ago. He said, this whole pandemic thing didn't necessarily create some trends. It accentuated or perpetuated some things were already happening. I kind of think that about Hurricane Ian. We already had all kinds of screwed upness with the fertilizer markets. We already were dealing with then foreign stuff on specialty crops. You know, that's always been the issue that in Peru or Mexico, they produce stuff. And so it sounded like Hurricane Ian might have just perpetuated these screwed upness elements that were already going on in the marketplace. So let's start with your sweet spot, fertilizer or Florida produce. Which one you want to go with?
We can just start with fertilizer for now.
All right. Fertilizer. We doubled our price starting, what, a year and a half ago. Then we wondered if we were even going to get it. And here I am in the Indiana, you know, the I states. We need fertilizer to make corn, right? And so there was this whole thing, we're even going to be able to get our fertilizer. Well, we did get it, but we paid a lot for it. Take me to, here we are, fall of 2022. Take me to spring 2023. What can I expect? What's going on with fertilizer?
Well, to kind of backtrack and just kind of see it at a high level, I mean, what we have in agri-food systems and agri-food markets is a very, very complex system that is just very interconnected, very, very concentrated and interdependent, and it's overly optimized for profitability. which means that there's no resilience built that's built into the system because it's all been inked out for maximum profits. And to your point, this pandemic and then the extreme weather events and the supply chain disruptions has created this cascading impacts that is causing these systems to unravel. And we are now suffering for that lack of resiliency in the form of very high prices with rampant inflation that is going to persist for quite some time. And that's the unfortunate thing. But when we start,
I don't like the word. I understand exactly why you're using it. No, in no way am I bashing on your choice of words. Resiliency, the consumer thinks that means we're just a minute away from starvation. You know what I mean? And that's not true at all. Your point is the Japanese manufacturers, starting in the 70s and certainly by the 80s, were the cream of the crop worldwide. And they invented a thing called JIT, just in time, meaning they didn't bring on a bumper for that Toyota until like 8 hours before the Toyota was being manufactured. The bumper came in on a truck. Why sit on a warehouse full of bumpers for 90 days when just in time? Essentially, our food system in North America made the exact same change. We were like, we're going to be basically just in time. We're going to be lean and mean because our margins are low. Our food prices are very affordable for the mass. And to do that, we have really no slack built into the system. That's kind of what you're saying. So I just want to make sure that the listeners like, is he bashing, saying we're not resilient? God damn it. We get through all. It's not to say that we can't get through Hurricane Ian's. It's more that we don't have a lot of slack because we're that efficient.
Exactly. And just to give you an example, I mean, 90% of all domestic fruit and vegetable production is produced out of a few counties in Southern California, which means that if something goes wrong in Southern California, that you're going to have some major, major impacts. I mean, you have a lot of the strawberries, winter strawberries that are coming out of Plant City, my hometown. And so if something happens to the production in Plant City, there goes a lot of your winter strawberry market. So you have these very concentrated systems. And that's what I mean by the lack of resiliency. And with the Toyota model, you had a lot of these clusters. And so Toyota is able to source in a very local area. And so you didn't have to worry about bringing in material from all the way across the country, you know, 3,000 miles, shipping in stuff from barges all the way from Asia. It was very localized. And now you have this globalized world, which means it's a lot more complex. Greater complexity means greater things can go wrong. And so that's just kind of setting the stage for this discussion about fertilizer. You know, the good news is when we start talking about for potash, and you know, a lot of the stuff when Russia invaded Ukraine, we've already kind of calculated in the disruptions to potash supplies for going into the next season. Prices have somewhat stabilized. They probably will go up a little bit, but nowhere near what we saw this past year. For phosphate, so the Mosaic has a lot of major production facilities here in Florida. They've been shut down a couple of weeks, but from what I've heard in the industry, they're getting it back up online. So it's a very minor disruption. You're going to see some probably localized spikes, but it's not this massive disruption. I'm not as much concerned about the availability of phosphate. Thankfully, like I said, I believe that they had very minor damage. They were able to bring the plants back up online. So things should be fairly normal by the end of the month, from what I've seen. My big concern going into the next season is actually when it comes to nitrogen. And the reason being is when we start looking at nitrogen markets worldwide, especially in Europe, you have high natural gas prices, you have a lack of supplies. And so a lot of the major chemical and ammonia plants there in Europe are beginning to shut down. The United States imports about 15% of its nitrogen needs. And the big
isn't that among the big three. So the person that's listening to this is not agronomically inclined, NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, the three big macronutrients, et cetera, et cetera. Isn't that the one that we're least dependent on foreign markets for? You just said we only bring in 15% nitrogen. We make 85% of our own in.
Yes, that is correct. So it is the least. And so it's a weird thing because nitrogen is the one that we have the best domestic supplies on. However, nitrogen is the most important nutrient, period. You need nitrogen if you're going to grow corn, if you're going to grow anything.
Right.
And so the fact that we need that 15% of the market means we're not as vulnerable, but that's still a pretty large supply that we do bring in.
Because we use a boatload of nitrogen, is your point. So even though we only import 15%, it's kind of like, yeah, we also need, it's like 15% of the most important thing, right?
Exactly. And so my concern, you know, and this is kind of in this realm of hypotheticals right now, where it remains to be seen, is that you're going to have price arbitrage opportunities. And essentially, the market is going to have a higher price for nitrogen there in Europe because they don't have that domestic supplies because of the natural gas situation. And that means that nitrogen, which would be going into North American markets, into the US markets, is instead going to go to Europe. And so I'm a little bit nervous that we might see a lot tighter supply of nitrogen going into the planting season. Yep. I definitely believe that prices are going to go up, probably to what we saw at the heights last year for nitrogen. That would not surprise me. It does appear that the price for urea topped out to be about $8.50 or so a ton. NOLA price for spot price, that's probably about the ceiling, depending on where commodity prices go. But I would not be surprised to see urea and UAN prices continuing to go up into the next season to where we saw last year. And
to the person that's a cranberry producer that doesn't even get this, that's listening to the Business of Ag podcast, urea and UAN, go ahead and give me, because those are forms of nitrogen.
Yes.
I want to make sure that the person that's maybe not, and this is obviously important because it's all the same net. It's all the same thing. We're trying to get nutrients, mm-hmm. but it's also in different forms. And some end up being, they all rise and fall together, but they also might vary based on the manufacturer of them, correct?
Yeah. So urea is essentially a granular form of dry nitrogen that can be applied. And then UAN, U32, is a liquid form of nitrogen that can be applied. So the spot market for urea tends to be a little bit more volatile. It's a lot easier to ship. UAN is a little bit more difficult to ship because it's a liquid. And so that's, you know, something to consider as well as we're looking at the markets. And, you know, but going back to it, that's something that we need to watch carefully. And a lot of that, how tight the nitrogen market may be, what the prices are going to do, is really going to be influenced by what goes down in Europe for this coming year and what we see for, do ammonia plants really shut down? Do they have a massive shortage of nitrogen fertilizers going into their planting season? Another thing to watch is the chemical precursors that are being manufactured by companies such as BASF. And how is that going to impact the second, third order impacts down the line for different crop protections? Because a lot of those precursor materials are going to China. And that's where a lot of you have a chemical manufacturing for chemical for crop protection. And that comes back into the United States. And so seeing those different nodes and how it impacts down the chain is going to be something we're going to have to watch very, very carefully into the future.
So thank you. And the issue on nitrogen in particular, you know, the average person that doesn't, you know, lives in suburbia doesn't realize energy equals fertilizer when it comes to nitrogen. I mean, you have to have, we use fossil fuels to make it. Mm-hmm. I mean, other stuff we dig out of the ground, but nitrogen is manufactured, right? And so you need energy. And that's going to be a real issue when you're talking about, they're saying that European factories are shutting down. That's a fact. Wall Street Journal article 3 weeks ago talked about the deindustrialization, particularly like Eastern Europe. They ain't got no energy. They can't make aluminum, you know, whatever. Same thing with fertilizer. We're losing out on production of it because of the energy situation in Europe. Am I right?
Yes. I mean, that is correct. I mean, you have to have it. And so the main way that we produce nitrogen is through ammonia, which is essentially by igniting natural gas. And so there is a direct correlation with nat gas prices and nitrogen prices. Yep. The demand for nitrogen, so the price of commodities, is also a major impacting element. So if we have high commodity prices for corn and soy, that's going to impact prices. I mean, the other thing in demand is what is being planted. So one of the interesting things in the United States is normally we plant about 90 to 91 million acres of corn and about 89 to 90 million acres of soy. But because of the high prices for nitrogen, we actually saw that flipped. We saw between 90 and 91 million acres of soy and about 89 to 90 million acres of corn. And because soy really doesn't need that much corn, we saw a massive drop in the demand.
So, by the way, that was the big prediction, Nathan, going into spring, that we were going to, for the ag trade said, this will only be like the third time or fourth time in our nation's history where soybean acres will be greater than corn acres in the United States. That was the narrative all till May. And then the WASDE report comes out here last week, and I dug it up and I dug up some other stuff. It turns out it was 87 million acres of soybeans and still 89.9 acres of corn. So it didn't happen the way they said it was going to happen this year. And that was all predicated on the fertilizer prices, right? But it ended up still not doing that way, because I'm convinced people in the Midwest still love to plant corn. But, you know, nitrogen be damned. So you think we're going to see this 2023, where it finally does happen, where the acres of soy do go more than corn because of nitrogen availability?
It's definitely possible. I think it is really going to be determined what happens in Europe. I think a lot what you're probably going to see too is different places, like in the South, is where you may have like a choice between, you know, cotton, soy, or corn. That may be, you know, depending on what the nutrient availability is. I think you're going to see, and that's, I mean, there's a lot of different factors that go into it. Because, I mean, if corn prices continue to remain really, really high, then you have a good lock on your supply of nitrogen, then yeah, you can plant. If corn prices plummet, then yeah, that's probably going to be a big determining factor, is prices as much for commodities as much as availability of the fertilizers. I think those are going to be the two factors to look for.
And that's the one I want to hear about, is the actual availability. Before we do that, I want to remind our listeners, a company that you need to put on your phone and you check this out is a company called AgVisor Pro. My buddy Rob Syke, a smart dude, Canadian entrepreneur, agricultural entrepreneur, started AgVisor Pro. He started multiple businesses throughout his career. He's been a guest here on the podcast, but I really want you to check out this latest initiative they're doing, AgVisor Pro. It's an app. You put it on your phone, because the point is, farmers spend, it's an ungodly thing, according to AgVisor Pro's research, 17 to 19% of a farmer's time is spent just acquiring information. Well, why not shorten the curve? As Rob always says, if you shorten time and space, you make money. So if you can shorten your information search to using the AgVisor Pro app, it's real simple. There's a bunch of experts on there. You just put it on your phone. AgVisor Pro, don't cost you nothing to put the app on your phone. You go on there and say, I need to know about this. You find an expert that can answer your questions, find somebody that has been there and done that, and they will steer you to the information you need. AgVisor Pro, it's an app. Put it on your phone. Don't cost nothing. And you can also be an expert on AgVisor Pro, meaning you could become an expert that someone else is seeking out because of the stuff that you know. Go check it out, AgVisor Pro. All right, Nathan, availability. We've now been hearing this. This will be our third season. It was 2 years ago we started the whole thing. Supply chain, pandemic, blah, blah, blah. Are we even going to be able to get the inputs we need? We got the inputs we need. Some of the seasoned agricultural people are like, man, they're starting to realize I know my shit, because I'm having to really go back here and do some new formulations, or I'm having to change up some stuff. We used some old chemistry. It really got a little tight, but we ended up being fine. Then this year, same story. Are we going to have availability issues based on the Russia-Ukraine problem and what's going on with energy markets and Europe? Is that where our supply problems are threatened, or is it somewhere else?
I would say it's definitely the biggest threat to nitrogen without question is what's going on with European energy markets, with European ammonia and nitrogen markets. That is the number one thing to watch without question. I think what I view is you may see kind of in similar years, localized shortages where people are waiting till the last minute to get their fertilizer needs, especially their nitrogen needs. You know, they don't have very strong relationships with their suppliers, and they're kind of caught, you know, waiting to the last minute, and they're waiting. Yeah, prices are probably going to come down. And then they realize, oh crap, there's not anything there. It's going to be probably localized and very, very, like, you're going to see a few areas, but I don't think it's going to be like, oh my gosh, I can't get any nitrogen. Because remember, we only import about 15% of our nitrogen needs, and a lot of that's coming from Canada as well. You know, Trinidad and Tobago is the number one supplier for nitrogen imports. Something like 65% of the nitrogen imports are coming from there. And so, you know, there's a lot of complexities in these markets. And I think, you know, the best thing that we can do is, you know, lock in those contracts, lock in that, you know, pre-buy as much as you can. If you can take delivery, and if you have the warehouse space, if you have the cash flow, that's not a bad idea. But there are ways to offset and mitigate that risk. It's going to get tighter. How tight remains to be seen. I don't want to be apocalyptic gloom and doom, because there's a lot of things we just don't know. It may just be a minor blip. It could be severe. It really depends on what happens in Europe. And all we can do is wait and see, unfortunately.
We've been hearing, and the thing is, I don't like sky is falling, chicken little kind of stuff, but we have, boy who cried wolf kind of thing. We have been hearing about, oh gosh, you know, you're not going to be able to get this stuff, buy early. We've been hearing that now for two seasons. So you can understand where the ag producer might be a little skeptical of all the doom and gloom talk. Talk about Florida, since you're the Florida guy and you're in the Florida, you live there, you work there, you're from there. And also we bring fertilizer in. So the fertilizer that comes out of those plants there is P, right?
Yeah, phosphate.
Yeah. So the phosphates come out of there and they are impacted, but you said they might be like dealing with 2 week shutdowns. They can make up for that just by working a little overtime. Is that what you're saying? Don't worry about the phosphates, Marcus, and the phosphorus availability is going to be okay.
From what I saw in some of the reports from Mosaic, they, you know, we're going to have production that was declined by about 200 to 250,000 tons. I don't have the numbers in terms of how much potash the United States is bringing in, but there are ways to, you know, make that up. We can import a little bit more from Morocco.
Wait. It's phosphorus or potassium that we're dealing with Florida issues?
Phosphate.
Yeah, it's phosphates. So on the phosphate stuff, you think we're going to be a little held up on production, but we can make up for it by the time we need it.
Yes, I believe that we can definitely make up for it. I don't think it's going to be a severe, it's going to be a disruption, but it's not going to be a severe disruption.
Okay, then potassium, we get a lot of that from Canada, but also then isn't that where the Russia thing comes into play?
So Canada, so Russia and Belarus produce about 35% of the world's potash. And Canada is the number one producer of potash. I think there's something along the lines of like 32%. Of global potash, and the United States almost exclusively gets all of its potash out of Canada. So we pretty much have internalized supply lines for potash. It's other countries, other importers, India, Brazil, who are reliant on those markets for potash coming out of Russia and Belarus. Those other countries, other nations are going to be the ones who are most impacted, I would say. And again, we've kind of already priced that in with all the trade embargoes and things like that over the past year. So the market has pretty well priced that in. So it's, I mean, I'm not going to say it can't get worse, but from what we've seen so far, things are pretty much already priced in. We have a certain level of certainty from the standpoint of the market's adjusted.
And we have the stuff.
Yes.
We have the stuff.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So moving from then the fertilizer, just fertilizer, we said, okay, you're the Hurricane Ian guy because you live and work there. How bad was your business disrupted? You know, you bring in fertilizer, you blend it, you're talking about rail and you talk about what you do. Were you guys screwed for a week, 2 weeks? Are you still screwed? What's going on?
Where I'm located in Hillsborough County, Florida, I was pretty well unimpacted. We had a few barrels, you know, strewn across the yard. We had a storm drain blow over, lost power for maybe an hour or two, but we were really, really lucky where we were at. You go about 30, 50 miles south down to, you know, Wauchula around the Peace River, and they were completely flooded out. I mean, a lot of those people were out without power for well over a week. A lot of farmers for peppers, for tomatoes down in those areas lost pretty much everything with their farms and on the crops that were in the ground. Citrus was absolutely devastated. So a lot of the citrus is down there around that, you know, Naples, Fort Myers area, Immokalee area going up straight, you know, Hardy County, Polk County. And a lot of those trees lost their crops, you know, 50 to 90%, sometimes 100% for some groves. USDA announced the other day that the orange harvest before the hurricane was going to be 28 million boxes.
Mm-hmm.
That was before factoring in the impacts that we've seen to citrus. It's going to be, I would say, with fairly strong confidence that it's probably going to be below 25 million. It could be as low as 20 million. I'm afraid that's the rumors that I'm seeing. 20 million boxes.
Okay, so you're talking about we might have peeled
citrus.
Off, we might have citrus. Off, we might have peeled off one third of citrus production with this storm?
Potentially. It could be worse. I mean, we're still trying to figure out exactly how bad. It's not even just the problem for Florida citrus isn't just the impact that we've seen like to the harvest itself. It's the damage to the trees.
Uh-huh.
For those listeners who may not be aware, so Florida has been combating a disease called citrus greening. It's a parasite that's spread by the Asian psyllid. It essentially gets into the sap of the tree and it basically clogs the arteries of the tree. And so the tree is starved of nutrients. Yeah. And it's been in the state for about 15 years or so. And it's just been this problem because there's not a cure for greening. All we can do is kind of treat the symptoms to try to keep the tree alive for as much as possible, for as long as possible.
Yeah, aren't we off? Like, I mean, I've read a few articles about this. By the way, anybody that's listening to me for repeat times knows already my sentiments about China and the entire continent of Asia. But just one more thing that we brought over from Asia that's destructive to our ecosystem and to our economy, citrus greening. Remember the Asian The emerald ash borer has destroyed my woods, all of my ice trees. So yes, screw China. I hate China. And I'm not very happy about from carp to citrus greening. Anyway, the production was already pretty well harmed over the last decade by this parasite. And now you've got that and the storm. Are you saying that the storm damage is worse because the trees were already vulnerable?
Yes, exactly. And just the industry itself is very, very fragile. And it's just been one body blow after another for the industry. We had a big freeze happen at the beginning of the year that really did a lot of damage to Florida citrus. And you have the problem where people are drinking less fruit juice because they have it through their minds. Oh, there's the sugar in this fruit juice, so we shouldn't drink it because sugar is bad when it's a natural sugar. Mm-hmm. And it's ridiculous, some of that the bad health food advice that is going on when you need the vitamin C. And, you know, orange juice is like it's a natural, occurring sugars. And so we have demand for citrus going down, which means prices are going down with high fertilizer prices. That means the margins for, the profitability for a lot of these groves are already on the cusp. And now you have this, the output is very low too, and the quality is very low because of this disease with greening. And now you have the hurricane come through, and it's just this one bam, 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 bam approach that really has Florida citrus reeling. And it is getting to a point where, it is very, very grim for Florida citrus. And it is going to take a lot of help from the state. It is going to take a lot of help from the federal government to keep this industry alive, to help us find a cure for greening so we can begin to rebuild. Because the problem that we see with Florida agriculture in general, and not just to citrus, you have all these individuals who are moving down to Florida. And you have, and when these groves, when these farms go out of business, it's not like they go to just follow land, they go to developers. And now all this pristine ag land becomes a concrete jungle that you lose permanently. Yeah. And that's the risk that we see to Florida agriculture.
Yeah, the risk is, and the consumer won't go without their orange juice. It'll just become Brazilian orange juice, right?
Mm-hmm. Or just import it from Mexico, which is a lot of what they're doing now as well. They're starting to import more and more because there's just not enough Florida oranges being produced. So it has to be supplemented from somewhere else.
The very state that gave us, it's not just for breakfast anymore. You're too young to remember that, but that was the whole shift that they increased orange juice consumption considerably by telling people it's not just for breakfast anymore. Mm-hmm. Once people decided they could put some Smirnoff in it and have it in the afternoon, away we were to screwdrivers. Okay. What do you see, Nathan, that the people that are listening to this that are, in the seed business in Nebraska are not seeing that you see? You just told us about citrus. What else? Like specialty crop stuff. There's kind of like the perfect storm. We had the pandemic stuff. We had supply chain issues. We had then the fact that you've got Hurricane Ian, but you already were dealing with, as you talked about, 4 million new people, as the article I read, 4 million new Floridians in the last decade. Like Florida gained 4 million residents, I think, over the last 10 years, is the article I read. What's happened with Florida agriculture with all the goings on?
So Florida agriculture, our biggest problem is just the disease pressures from the Asian psyllid, from citrus greening, but also unfair trade practices coming out of Mexico, where Mexico is dumping fresh produce on the market. Given how contentious politics is these days, it says a lot. The fact that the only thing that Florida Republicans and Florida Democrats agree on is that Mexico is undoubtedly dumping on the market. And what's more is this produce industry is a front to smuggle fentanyl into the country. Why is it that it can oftentimes cost less money to get a truck of strawberries going from Mexico to New York City than it is from, say, Mexico down up into California? And
you think the answer is it's not just produce that's on that truck?
It is absolutely the case. Congressional Representative Kat Comax, she basically said that, she was at the border and inspected a truck and saw it loaded with, marijuana and fentanyl. And it was this produce truck. And that's what she saw. And then this is what is happening in the market. And
I remember seeing that report, by the way. It didn't get nearly the amount of coverage that it should have.
Yeah. It is a massive, massive problem. And so that is a big threat to Florida agriculture. I mean, the other impact that we're seeing to U.S. specialty crops is, you know, I mentioned earlier that about 90% of domestically produced fruits and vegetables are coming out of California. Well, you have massive, massive droughts, and that's going to continue to get worse. And the problem that California has is that it hasn't built any water infrastructure since Ronald Reagan was governor.
Yeah. So the 1970s, the last time they did it. So 50 years ago is the last time they created created water infrastructure. The population is what, you know, nearly doubled in that time in California. We still have a climate that can produce stuff that you can't produce almonds in Nebraska. Right. So, I mean, there's certain stuff that California is climatologically just better at. And so, but they need water. So they've got that issue. And like you said, it's getting drier. Does that just mean that we bring more crap in from foreign countries, or does it bode well for Florida that California has a drought?
It varies because so California can produce it year round. And so there's a seasonal window that Florida can hit. And that's going to be beneficial to Florida because it's going to be able to hit, take over a bit more of that window. And that's going to be, that is good. But again, the problem that Florida has is not, there's less California and more, a lot of the produce from Mexico is getting dumped at the same time that a lot of Florida agriculture is coming online.
Timing.
Yes. And the issue is the timing of the markets. And I think what we're going to see more and more, especially when we look at the development of urban agriculture, vertical farming, et cetera, I think we're going to begin to see, you know, just out of necessity because of the lack of water in California, more co-location of specialty crops within, you know, the major production hubs and the seasonality and bringing back the more localized traditions for, you know, perishable commodity production. Because, you know, why do you want to produce a strawberry that's, you know, out in California that has to be survived being shipped all the way to New York City? You're not breeding for taste. You're not breeding for nutrition. You're breeding a strawberry that can survive being shipped across the country and then has that extended shelf life. If you can produce it more locally, now you can start breeding more for taste and for nutrition. And that's where I see, by necessity, by the technology that we're seeing, the development of specialty crops in this country over the next couple of decades.
It's a great topic, by the way, and that's not where I was expecting our interview to go, but I talked about it in my book, Food Fear. The guy, Mark Schatzker, wrote a book called The Dorito Effect, and he was actually one of my early guests on this podcast way back when, about that very issue. The average consumer knows that a tomato out of your garden smells like the earth, has flavor. It's amazing. Go to the Kroger or Walmart and buy a tomato, and it's essentially red, spherical water. You know, it has no flavor. And actually, you can even argue that the nutritional content is not as great because we bred it for transportability, right? And that's exactly what you're talking about. there's even now more compelling evidence that flavor equals nutrition. In other words, they go together. Your body craves this thing because your body's saying, I want that nutrient. And also that flavor sometimes ties to nutrient. And we've gotten all messed up with essentially that's the whole point of his book, The Dorito Effect, that we've through artificial flavoring and again, massive production. We just said, let's get lots of product and transportability. So here's the thing. You wouldn't think a guy in Florida would be speaking about the ills of transport and stuff. Remember, it's not just for breakfast anymore. Man, take that orange juice from Florida and ship it to South Dakota. We're not going to probably grow oranges in South Dakota no matter what. But your point is well taken that you think that some of the vertical farming might end up occupying a bigger space in ag.
Yes. I mean, you're not going to get away with these production hubs. I mean, you're always going to have Plant City strawberries. You're always going to have Florida citrus. You're going to have these big production hubs. You know, it doesn't matter what happens with agriculture. The Midwest is always going to be the king for corn, for soy, for wheat, et cetera, because of the geography. You cannot change these geographic endowments. And the geographic endowments of Florida make it a key hub for winter fruit and vegetable production, period. That's not going to change. But when you think about, you know, earlier I was talking about the fragility of our agri-food systems and how vulnerable they are to disruptions, building a more resilient agri-food system means you're basically deleveraging and diversifying the production hubs. And so now you don't have 90% of all your fruit and vegetables domestically coming out of California, it's divvied out. So you still may have, say, half or something, but that's a lot of fruit and vegetable production that can go to a lot of other places, and really means that if something happens in California or happens in Florida or happens somewhere else, there's other nodes that can pick up the slack. And so there's not a severe disruption. Mm-hmm. And that's where I see things going. And again, we need to be investing in Florida agriculture because you have this overdependence in California. And so Florida is poised to be able to scale up faster than other geographies because mm-hmm. we're already producing a lot of this fruit and vegetable production. Mm-hmm. And that's where, again, it's going to require a lot of assistance from the state and also at a federal level, because at a federal level, we don't really care about fruit and vegetable production. It's just kind of ignored. When we have this problem with obesity, if we want to address obesity in this country, if we want to address the problems of health and have preventative healthcare, have people eat more healthy fruits and vegetables, fresh fruits and vegetables. That's a great way of offsetting it. And so we need to think about a federal policy and invest in perishable commodity production in these different locations.
You're covering a lot of ground here, Nathan. You're a sharp guy. Question for you, though, on scaling up. That bodes well for Florida, but again, there's still the issue of foreign competition, and it's fine to compete if it's done fairly. And you're saying that what we have right now is fentanyl buys the bus, and they just throw some tomatoes on the, that's what you're really saying, is that it's not a fair marketplace because it's distorted because of the criminality.
Yes, the criminality is a big problem of it. You have Mexico that's also illegally subsidizing the production of fresh fruits and vegetables in clear violation of the NAFTA and the USMCA agreements. So you have like multiple confounding factors. You have illegal production, illegal subsidization. They're dumping on the market. They're using it as a vehicle for smuggling fentanyl. And that is the problem. And the way Mexico likes to play the game is, if we try to tighten up border restrictions and track down on the dumping on the market, basically Mexico threatens corn and soybean imports from the right. United States. And then it gets shut down by, the corn lobby out in the Midwest. I mean, that's just the truth. I'm just trying to state the facts here. And that's the politics of why.
And they are a huge market, by the way. They are projected to buy $27 billion worth of our ag output this year, Mexico. And that's second. They've climbed to being our second biggest ag customer behind China. Point I make is they are 3/4 as big of a customer as China with 1/10 of the amount of population. So we do want to have a healthy relationship with Mexico. The tough part is the cartels, et cetera, are in charge of and then the government subsidizes the produce. So it's not good for Florida and especially crop is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing is, if we want to, outsource all of our fruit and vegetable production to Mexico, kind of like we outsourced all of our manufacturing to China, I mean, I guess we could do that, but there's a cost and there's a consequence to it. We've seen in the pandemic what happens when you let foreign countries right. control all of your manufacturing and you rely upon them. I mean, it's not a good situation.
In fact, I believe that we are going to continue to see a deglobalization in your lifetime. And even in my lifetime, we've never seen anything other than massive amounts of globalization. I worked in a factory. My wife and I were both factory workers when we were, in college. And my factory's done. They don't make that stuff here anymore. And I've pointed out for a long, long time, this makes us vulnerable. Well, it looks like the rest of America is starting to realize what I said 30 years ago. We need to make stuff. So there is going to be a deglobalization push, as there already is, because of China holding us over a barrel, OPEC holding us over a barrel, literally. On produce, I think that we need a healthy Florida because we don't want to become dependent on Mexico because, again, you give them too much power and all of a sudden we're vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And again, it comes down to this issue of price. Remember when I said earlier is we've over-optimized our entire agri-food system for the lowest, for profit maximization. And then we sit around and we wonder why we have all these problems with obesity and these second and third order impacts to our agri-food systems. We look at why is it the farmers used to be making 40 cents on the dollar in the 1980s, and now they're making less than 15 cents on the dollar. I mean, back in the pandemic, a lot of the growers in the Dakotas, they were, 40% of their revenue was coming from federal government transport payments at one point. We talk about the future of agriculture, but where is the future of agriculture where farmers can actually afford to farm? You know, we're losing that rich tradition. We're losing those rich communities because all we care about is profit maximization. When, you know, it's not, I mean, look, I'm in small business. I like money. Profit's a good thing, but making money is not the highest order good. And when you orient an entire society and our political economy around that, that's where you say, yeah, let's just outsource all of our fruit and vegetable to Mexico. Let's outsource our entire manufacturing to China. Let's outsource all of our oil to Saudi Arabia and Venezuela, et cetera, because, well, it's just cheaper that way. It's not. Well,
by the way, Nathan, that was pretty much the mindset for decades. And I was one of the guys out here, like, I'm a capitalist. I'm a small biz guy, same as you, I'm talking. But I'm like, I know what happens. They taught me in history, back when we still taught real history, the United States has never won a war. We just outproduced the competition. You know, we didn't beat Germany because we had smarter generals. We beat Germany because of our ability to produce. We were able to outproduce them. Well, that's something that we need to regain on this whole thing. So that's one positive. And I agree with you that I'd rather have Florida agriculture. And I think the average consumer appreciates the fruits of our labor, literally. But would they pay another nickel to make sure that it's the United States being not compromised? And probably so. But the tough part is, right now we're in an inflationary period. You know, the consumer's paying 13.5% more for groceries than they did a year ago. It's probably a tough ask right now, but I think long-term we need to, for our nation's security, to have a strong ag sector, even if it means that we have to play a little more mean with some of our foreign competitors.
Well, the great irony is, again, when you have everything that's in this just-in-time mentality, and you have a supply shock. Well, it's basic supply and demand. Demand is normalized, if not higher, because of all the, you know, the government spending and transfer payments and stimulus checks. So demand is going up, supply is going down, higher prices, inflation. And until you fix that supply issue, you're not going to fix the problem of, you know, inflation. And the only way that you can have lower inflation is demand destruction, which means you go into recession. And so we really need to be focusing on that production quotient. You cannot have consumption without production. And as a country, we've outsourced production. And I, you know, this is getting a little bit more into political economy, but I think agriculture is really indicative and is a really good litmus test for understanding like what we've seen overall, because, you know, we all have to eat at the end of the day. We all have to eat. And so if we can really focus on fixing the issues in our agri-food supply chain, especially for fruits and vegetables, I think that can give us a good model that we can scale out and apply to different sectors as well.
A lot to say. I think we should probably get out of here, though, because I'm going to have you back for more in-depth on global economics of food. But certainly you and I both agree, I don't want the demand destruction, meaning I don't want the consumer in the United States of America to not be able to afford food, which is where we're heading right now. I want us to just be able to have lots of supply, lots of choices, and take care of inflation that way. And I was interviewed in a media outlet about 3 weeks ago where I said that exact thing. What's the answer? I said, probably just more supply, because you sure as hell, I live in a blue collar neighborhood here in Huntington, Indiana. Meaning I've got a, you know, it's a factory town. I don't want these people to go without, you know, and I know what you're talking about. Get me out of here, Nathan. Give me your final wrap on the episode I'm calling Fertilizer, Florida Agriculture and Hurricane Ian. What do I need to know?
I don't know. I mean, there's just a lot of things going on these days in global ag markets. I mean, Florida agriculture, you know, we're here. I mean, I'm seventh generation Floridian, third generation in the family business with fertilizer. I'm not going anywhere. You know, I know a lot of growers. It's been a tough few years for Florida agriculture, but we're not going anywhere. You know, we are going to make sure that we pull through this.
Since we opened up with fertilizer, I want to go out one thing. Will we have what we need? Will we have the fertilizer we need? We talked about the Mississippi River barge system. Will it go to rail since the barges are unable to move with the dryness in the Mississippi? Will we have the fertilizer we need to grow crops in 2023?
That's the one thing that I don't really know. I mean, a lot of it's going to be dependent upon, can we get rain and get the Mississippi up to normal? You've got all the railroad strikes, and that's going to be a major concern as well. And when you think about fuel prices, it takes a lot more fuel to move things via rail than via barge, via truck versus via rail.
Yeah, right. So ship is the most efficient, rail is the second most efficient, truck is the third. If, you know, and all of a sudden, if we're having to put fertilizer on trucks, then the price of fertilizer, if we have the availability, is going to be skyrocketed.
Yes, and that's definitely a major concern on the logistics side of it. But we're seeing disruptions for the barge system and the potential disruptions for a strike could cause some serious problems. I mean, the only quote unquote good thing, silver lining, is that it's still early in the season. And so there's still time to position the fertilizer to where it needs to be in Q4 and Q1 before planting. But the question is, how long does this persist?
So
If the bar.
your gut right now says we're probably going to be okay. Too soon to tell because there's too many. There's the barge issue with the Mississippi, and then there's also the rail potential looming rail strike, which Biden said he fixed a month ago, which that's not true.
Unfortunately, it was not fixed. And I think probably the big disruption to agriculture is going to be more on the export side as we go into harvest and getting crops out of the United States more than getting the fertilizer in, just because of the timing of the seasons. It can still be pretty disruptive, but I think, to the input supplies, again, it's bad. It's still too early to tell. It's reason for a concern. I don't see a reason to panic just yet.
Come back in 6 months and talk to me about fertilizer.
That sounds good.
All right. Your name is Nathan Carson. My name is Damian Mason. Nathan, if they want to look you up, what do they need to do?
So I'm on Twitter. If you guys want to look me up on Twitter, it's ND Carson at
ND, like ND, like
it's
Nathan.
the letter N, the letter D Carson,
Got it.
Carson on Twitter. And so that's the best way to find me. My comments on ag, global ag issues, fertilizer issues, geopolitics, politics in general. So it depends on, where I'm at in the mood for the day.
Well, you're going to become a repeat guest on this podcast because I like what you had to say, and I like the fact that you bring great examples. And I'm going to never forget the term geographic endowment. I've never heard that before. When you talked about, I might have called it climatological or geographical or topographical advantage. Geographic endowment. That's one of the, that's my phrase of the day right there. His name is Nathan Carson. My name is Damian Mason. If you like what we're doing here, go back and check out past episodes. Remember also, I'm now on Acres TV. That's right. The Hefty Brothers started Acres TV. Go to watchacrestv.com and you can see my episodes there. Also on YouTube. And of course, wherever you get your audio podcast shows with somebody you know. If you like what we're doing here, reminder, I'm producing really cool stuff over at Extreme Ag. Extreme Ag is the farmers that are really forward thinking. They are doing trials, they're doing new products and talking about practices. I'm producing a podcast for them called Cutting the Curve. And also, I'm shooting a whole bunch of videos on site with them. So go and check out Extreme Ag. There's no E on the front of it, just extremeag.farm. Till next time, thanks for being here, Nathan.
Thank you so much. My
All right,
pleasure.
till next time, it's the Business of Agriculture. Well, that concludes another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture. This episode was brought to you by Pattern Ag. You know, everybody in agriculture understands the importance of soil health. We also keep an eye on our soil better than we ever did through advanced soil testing. But what if there was a company that provided predictive analytics? Not just checking out nutrients and all the elements that are in there, but also could tell you the degree of risk you face with disease and pest pressure. That's right. Pattern Ag can do that. They actually can tell you, hey, you're going to have a real issue here. You can preemptively, proactively treat for corn rootworm or cyst nematode or sudden death syndrome before the problem actually starts costing you yield. Go to pattern.ag. That's www.pattern.ag to find the nearest rep that can help you start doing better for your soil.